Our next case is Schindler v. Squires, 25-1557. And Mr. Councilor Schindler, you have reserved 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Let's wait just a little bit. Before you proceed, the court notices that you have filed a motion, Rule 38 motion, before the court.
Yes.
It's been pending before the court. The court has denied the motion.
Okay.
So you may proceed.
Okay, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is a case where there was alleged misconduct that was not misconduct, that was following the rules and procedures of patent office that were developed over decades. And following the case, the decision of the ALJ, the patent office actually amended their rules to permit the conduct that was allegedly misconduct. The rules in this case, what happened in this case was Michael Crowe was an attorney, a patent attorney. He was excluded from the patent office, but he retained his status as an attorney in good standing under New York law. He was able to have clients, he was able to have legal billings, and he referred work to me, which I worked on. I had powers of attorney from all clients, and I operated with him in the identical way that I operate.
Mr. Schindler, the PTO office found that you, determined that you had violated three categories of PTO regulations, correct?
It was the same, yes, it was the same conduct.
Three categories.
That's correct. It was the same conduct.
You don't challenge the underlying factual determinations that the PTO reached in its decision, correct?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. I challenged the fact that there was anything that was done incorrectly. I think this is mostly a question of the rules and regulations and the district court's failure to consider legal issues such as constitutional defenses. And it was also a question of the use of double hearsay by the patent office.
Why don't you address a hearsay question first?
Okay. There were no grievances filed against me. There were no clients that appeared. No clients testified. What happened was, at the hearing, the deputy OVD director, Diana Alesta, appeared. She entered the evidence. She had said she had spoken to seven clients. Okay, who all gave me powers of attorney to act on their behalf. None of them filed a grievance. She said she spoke to them by telephone. There were no notes taken. She took notes, but there were no recordings taken. She entered her notes into the record. I objected to the fact that no clients testified, no clients filed a grievance, and there was no actual harm filed to any clients, no clients lost any rights. There was no damage to anybody for anything. I objected to the double hearsay on the grounds that it was based on telephone conversations that were never recorded, that I had no knowledge of, and the evidence against me was her notes that I could not challenge, and I objected to it. When I sought to cross-examine her, the OED objected on the grounds that the rules didn't provide for it. The ALJ said, the rules may not provide for it, but as a constitutional matter, you probably have the right to cross-examine her, but I won't make...
Did you cross-examine
her? I wasn't allowed to cross-examine her on that. I cross-examined her on a couple of minor issues, actually not minor. I asked the OED deputy director, I said, are the drawings... This comes up as to who can prepare patent applications and papers in contemplation of filing. And I said, I asked Diana Alesta, the OED deputy, I said, are drawings part of the written description of a patent application? And she is a patent attorney, and she thought about it. She said, no. Now, draftsmen, for example, are used in this country. They're independent. They prepare the entirety of disclosure in design patent applications. So obviously, they're preparing documents of contemplation of patent applications for filing in the office. The rule that's somehow the unauthorized practice of law is overly broad. Foreign associates. Most of my work is dealing with foreign associates around the world. These foreign associates prepare PCT applications. They prepare national application, the 119, with foreign priority. I receive them, I review them, and I filed them. In the case of PCTs, they have to be filed as is, but you do get a chance to do a preliminary amendment. Again, eventually I get a power of attorney from those clients, but I deal just with the associate who generally deals with the inventor. Rarely, but sometimes they deal directly with the inventor in a case. I
don't see that the PTO takes issue with the with work that you did as an attorney, but rather work you did for another attorney.
That's
on behalf of another attorney, and that other attorney had been suspended from practice before the PTO.
But not from the practice of law. He was no different than, say,
before the PTO.
That's correct.
You haven't been suspended, as far as I know, suspended from the practice of law. You've been suspended from practice before the PTO.
Well, so was the other attorney. The other attorney, in fact, the same events or circumstances.
The other attorney being the other attorney that you're working with?
Yes. He was still a member in good standing at the New York Bar. Now, that's unusual to be expected.
But he had been suspended from the PTO.
Yes, but that's no different than, say, a foreign associate.
I understand. Your position is that because the other attorney was still a member of the bar, it was okay for him to participate in PTO proceedings through you. Is that what you're saying?
I had a power of attorney for more clients to act on their behalf. I had absolute discretion on what was filed. I was the only person who filed anything. And I found it under my own signature, my own contact information. I operated under the PTO rules as published in May of 1988, which talks about foreign agents and corporate liaisons and receiving instructions from them. Everything that was filed was filed under my sole professional discretion. There's no difference between what I did with this other attorney who was an attorney. If he had been disbarred from the state, you could argue that I was helping him. He had no right to have clients. But he had a right to have clients, and he's no different, for example, than my German patent associates or my British patent associates or Australia or Japan. They're not registered to practice. They're counsel clients. In fact, some of them don't even speak English. And I receive their cases, and they're filed. And most of these cases I review, I check. I usually often have to amend the claims to perform the U.S. practice.
I read the regulation that you're referring to, and it looked like it referred to just foreign agents and I think corporate representatives.
It actually said such as. So it was the regulation, the panel said originally decided, it was May 25th, 1988. It said, in practice, it is common for instructions relating to application of an inventor who is the client of the U.S. practitioner to be passed to the U.S. practitioner through intermediaries, such as corporate liaisons or foreign agents. It's not an exclusive list of who can do it. And it's, frankly, it's the same practice. And following the initial decision in June of 23, the patent office went ahead and changed the rules of practice or the professional responsibility proceedings to permit the exact conduct that was charged against me. At that point, the patent office should simply have said, we changed our rules. What we said was misconduct is no longer misconduct. I can't prove it, but the odds are they amended the rules in view of my case. Because this is indistinguishable. What I've just read under the OEG, on the Official Gazette is indistinguishable from how I operate with this other attorney. He's able to counsel clients, let's say, in patent proceedings before the federal courts or trademark proceedings before state or federal courts. So he is allowed to discuss legal matters. He is allowed to talk about patent issues. He filed nothing in the patent office. He filed nothing under my name. I had powers of attorney. I signed everything. His contact information did not appear on my papers. I had spoken to some clients. I didn't speak to other clients. The ALJ found that that my communications with clients was reasonable and that no client was damaged and clients, no one lost rights and that the objectives of the clients were followed through. Okay, and so beyond the OED, we have a question about the district court. During the district court pendency, Lupa Bridal Enterprises came down. Lupa Bright was an interpretation that requires the district court to rule independently on all questions of law. I filed a complaint under 1338A during this proceeding. I also attacked the regulation, the local rule, as saying, I have a right, basically, to raise my constitutional questions, regardless of whether or not the local rule is valid. As once Lupa Bright came out, I think it's that electronics, Lupa Bright Enterprises, once that came out, it brought to the attention of the district court and said to reconsider the fact that I have a summary judgment motion as a timeliness of the proceeding. I have constitutional claims as to double hearsay, and these have to be considered independently. The district court, we briefed that, and the district court ignored it. 6 months later, they affirmed on the basis that PTO, it appeared that there was no, they basically deferred to the PTOs, and they found nothing wrong with what the PTO did. They made no independent legal findings. They did not follow the Supreme Court precedent, and there was no underlying conduct, and it has to be reversed. First of all, the district court did not follow the regulations. They did not follow the Supreme Court's Bright decision. And the underlying conduct is exactly what every patent attorney does. And it's what every draftsman does who prepares papers in contemplation of filing in the office. The rule was overly broad, and like I said, no client was damaged. Every client gave me a power of attorney. Every client had my contact information. Every client was able to completely contact me, and some did. And once they changed the regulations, the rules, they should have dropped it right there, because that was an obligation the PTO had. And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counselor Bargan.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Dennis Bargan, Assistant United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, on behalf of the USPTO Director in this appeal. The agency's rules of professional conduct, for obvious reasons, place extensive restrictions on the legal activities of those practitioners who, for ethical transgressions, have been suspended from practice before the agency. And that's at Section 11.58 of Title 37 of the Code of Federal Regulations. Those practitioners cannot, even when working under the supervision of an accepted practitioner as a paralegal, communicate with any client or give legal advice to any client about business before the court. Despite having been suspended from practice before the office because of significant ethical transgressions, Michael Kroll continued to work directly with and provide advice to clients he shared with the appellant, in this case, Mr. Schindler, including drafting their patent applications and responses to USPTO office actions during the patent examination process. And he was only able to conduct that advice, to draft those papers, because Mr. Schindler, at the end of the process, would file those papers with the PTO on their behalf. Nevertheless, after a lengthy administrative process and through several written decisions, an ALJ and then the Patent Office itself concluded that Mr. Schindler's involvement in this scheme violated a series of rules of professional conduct, including unauthorized practice of law, communications, and fee splitting, and imposed a 2-year suspension. The district court affirmed that order, and this court should similarly affirm.
How do you respond to the particular argument that because Mr. Kroll was still barred in New York, he was no different than what is provided in the Federal Register as somebody who could provide work to the appellant here?
So the USPTO's regulations define practice before the agency as conducting any business or giving any advice that relates to business before the agency. And drafting of patent applications and advice about patent applications is unquestionably business before the agency. And it's clearly contemplated in the regulations. The mere fact that Mr. Kroll may have still been able to practice law as a general matter into the state of New York did not mean that he was similarly authorized to engage in legal practice when it comes to the business of the agency. And the Supreme Court's decision in Sperry against State Bar of Florida speaks to that very question. The mere fact that an individual may be licensed to practice law generically in a state or a commonwealth does not necessarily mean that the rules that govern the patent bar similarly don't apply and that they don't have to have that other recognition. And here, especially with my colleague's comments about how he is no different than a British or an Australian patent agent, Mr. Kroll was not a foreign patent agent. He was a suspended and then excluded practitioner.
I think what he says is the regulation says such as, and so therefore it should.
So it's not even a regulation, Your Honor. It's an official Gazette notice from about 40 years ago, and the upshot of that is the USPTO's policy determination that, for obvious linguistic reasons, we're not going to enforce a very strict rule of practice before the agency when it comes to these kinds of communications. It doesn't mean that someone who has been excluded from practice or suspended for ethical transgressions can continue with business as usual if they find another practitioner who remains licensed to practice before the agency to hit send on the electronic filings at the end of the day.
What's your response to Mr. Schindler's argument that his conduct was no more than that allowed or permitted to a foreign agent under the regulation?
Yeah, as I was just,
there's no rationale to the difference in treatment between how he's treated and how a foreign agent is treated, especially since it's the same underlying conduct.
So these situations, as I was just addressing with Judge Kroll, Judge Stoll, they're not similarly situated. There is a person who is a foreign agent who is representing a client or is the agent of a client in a foreign country. There are any number of linguistic or logistical problems with enforcing a rule that says each and every one of those individuals must be licensed to practice before the PTO before communicating advice about what to do with a patent application before the agency. Here, what we're dealing with is an individual who was suspended and then excluded from practice as a result of ethical transgressions. There is a specific regulation that deals with that, Title 37, 11.58, and the situations are simply just not similarly situated. Unless the panel has any further questions, I'm happy to cede my time.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. Mr. Schindler, you have 3 minutes.
Okay. First, as an initial matter, I didn't just hit send when Michael Kroll sent me something. I reviewed it. I prepared everything. I prepared the amendments from scratch. And I prepared essentially the applications from scratch. I got a rough draft. He usually sent me the drawings from his outside draftsman, which is perfectly fine. The rules draw no distinction between foreign agents and excluded practitioners who are still attorneys. It also draws no distinction between general attorneys, let's say in a large firm, who may have a client and refer work to a patent attorney. Let's say, well, any general attorney in the United States who may get work and file and work with a patent attorney, you know, maybe this case falls in a gap or between, you know, in the gap of what's suspended and what's the difference between a foreigner. But in a sense, the argument of the government is that someone who was suspended and therefore not registered to practice is somehow different than someone who was never registered to practice in the first place. And whether something's in the official
position.
What?
I think that is his position.
Yeah, but I don't think the rules address it at all. And, you know, if Michael Kroll was not an attorney, if he was disbarred from New York, then I would agree. He has no right to practice law, period. But the idea, for example, that someone who's an attorney or someone who's overseas who's never been registered can't discuss what goes to a patent application, that's not the case. That's not reality. It's no different than a draftsman in this country who works in private business, prepares drawings. The drawings are documents in preparation, contemplation of filing in the office. What's the difference between, let's say, Michael Kroll went into the business of preparing drawings and sent it to me? How is that any different? And the answer is the rule should have been clearer because I followed the regulations. I had powers of attorney from every client. I had full discretion of what was filed. No one told me what to file. I signed everything. Some clients contacted me. Some clients didn't. And from what I can tell, when they changed the regulations in August of 2023, presumably because of my case, what I was accused of doing is somehow now acceptable. So that alone should be a basis for basically a full dismissal. So, you know, and I think that is about it. Any further questions?
Okay. Thank you, Counselor.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I thank the parties for their arguments, and this case will be taken under submission.